a shot in the dark, wary sort of spark. I'm a light that's too bright for me to see.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, here we go, kids. Episode 292. I should probably start working on an idea for episode 300, should I not? I'm putting some feelers out. The feeling, the idea is that it'll probably be another 2 hour live episode, like episode 200, except this time we'll probably get, we'll open up the phones, but we'll probably have some planned guests to come in. Not sure. It's going to be a question of whether we could pull this off even technically right now. Last one I did on site. I don't normally do live shows. So we're going to see what can happen. I'm doing my best to stall, though, by not doing shows. I apologize. This is the first show you're getting this week. So, no, it's not. It's the second show you're getting this week. But Tuesday, I just wasn't able to do it. I was just way too slammed and just did not get time to get it done. And then Wednesday, I got up at the crack of dawn. I went to bed early. I even took, you know, a sleeping pill, you know, one of those like Tylenol PM, except without the Tylenol things, just to make sure that I could go to bed that early. Got up at like 5, went down to the shop, got everything ready so I would have time to record before the day job, because I had 2 open to close shifts on the day job, and then realized that I had left my gear at home. So there was no time to get here, and I just was not going to rearrange the entire schedule at a shop and I don't own, because I didn't do my show. So alas, you went a couple days without a show, and I apologize. Anyway, so here in Denver, Colorado, it is a gorgeous day. It is ridiculous. It is beautiful today. I mean, absolutely insane beautiful today. Just early set, like right about 70. Just slight breeze. Just, I mean, sunny as all get out. Spring has sprung, ladies and gentlemen. And, you know, I tell you what, two things worries me about this. That means that, okay, great. Does that mean we're going to have a super hot summer? Which super freaks me out, because I hate heat. And the other thing is, is it going to come weird? Are we going to get like this weird, sometimes here in Denver, we get like April and early May, we just get like another winter that comes. And it's like 60, 60, 60, 10 degrees, a foot of snow, you know, we're like 20 degrees, foot of snow overnight, shuts everything down. It's like 55 the next day, 70 the next day, just sloppy, big, giant, wet spring snows. I remember a few years ago just getting one every Tuesday for 3 weeks in a row. We got our Tuesday foot. It was for like 3-4 weeks. It was like clockwork every Tuesday into Wednesday. I think we had 2 Wednesday snow days in a row. Anyway, so hoping that doesn't happen. So trucking along on Lent. I mean, I'm not killing it. I have not drank at all. Coming up on weekend number 2. Getting a little easier. It's a little harder. I mean, I don't know what to do though on the weekend. Hey, why don't you come over? We're all going to we should get together and it's always involved. I'm like, hey, we're going to have some wine, or hey, we're all going over to this bar to watch this. And I'm like, I mean, I can go to the Skylark and go dancing with my friends and like sit and drink club soda all night. But I'm like, really? Just, you know, I just take this as evidence of me untangling, because I had let the alcohol kind of get to, not, I mean, I'm not saying I was an alcoholic or anything. I'm just saying that I had kind of let it and other things to kind of numb me, you know, Facebook. And that's where I've really dropped the ball. I've kind of been by accident and just boredom, like sneak it out on Facebook. I never said I was giving it up. I was just going to use it only for business and maybe try to use my desire to get out on it to start working on the counter position in Calyx a little more on Facebook. But I have, in fact, just kind of like, I'll open it up because there's a, something I need to see for business. And then there's a, something that a friend of mine posted that I see. And before I know what I'm doing, I'm commenting on it. It's ridiculous. That's the real addiction of my life. I should go back to drinking wine and just give up Facebook cold turkey. But I've done pretty good on the diet. I was supposed to be doing autoimmune paleo. I haven't been able to keep off of the nightshades, man, peppers and tomatoes and stuff, mostly because I've been going to Chipotle a lot. And it's like, and the other thing is I've been slipping on rice. I need to just start, I need to figure out a way to just carry tons of sweet potatoes with me or something. Cause I get hungry and I need a starch and, yeah, I don't know. Rice, white rice though, pretty cool, pretty not a big deal. So I've been sticking to white rice on occasion, but so I'm not killing it. But here's the thing is that with the way I do Lent normally is I go, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do this and I'm going to cold turkey on this and I'm not doing this at all. And I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. And then I mess up on one of my little things. Just a little bit, like I just eat some rice and I go, oh, to hell with it. There's no use doing this. I suck. See, I can't do anything. I quit. I'm just going to just drink a bunch of wine and eat candy bars and just like sit on Facebook all night, you know? So what I'm really giving up is I'm giving up for Lent. Yeah. So I gave up on giving up. I did the opposite of that once. So my freshman year at Thomas Aquinas College, I was in an absolute, complete and total just like depression when Lent rolled around. I was in such desolation and people would ask me what I was giving up for Lent. And I'd tell them I'm giving up hope. So I gave up hope for Lent one year. Didn't give up hope this year. So, but overall now I think, you know, we're coming into like, you know, another week of Lent. I'm trying to start dialing back the screen time. I have dialed it back a little bit, but not as much as I want. And I want to start really dialing up the spiritual practice a little bit. I haven't replaced all this with, I've been super busy though, but I haven't replaced this with either spiritual practices or any real kind of like actual mindfulness that I'm kind of, you know, living more intentionally or, you know, but you know what? It's like maybe what I'm shooting for is 100% and maybe on the last day of Lent, I'm at like 92. All right. You know what? I'm going to have to be okay with that because like I said, I gave up giving up. So Mark Gieschek, my partner over on the Over the Counter podcast, which we haven't done one in a while. We finally did one. And then now I have to record this show anytime I have a chance to record. And Mark's like, I'm like, hey, Mark, you want to come on my show? No, I want to do an over-the-counter. And I'm like, oh, I need to do a show. Well, I want to do an over-the-counter. And then I can't get Mark on the show. So that's why Mark's never on the show. I see and talk to Mark about all these interesting things every day. And I can't get him on the show. But hey, speaking of on the show, shout out to Jeremy Rivera from The Little J. I've already gotten some compliments about the interview with Jeremy Rivera. I think it was a really interesting conversation. But I need to do more interviews. I've been getting compliments on my interviewing work there. So maybe I need to just start doing a little more of that. I know I've said that before. I found this software that could make this super easy, and it's like 30 bucks a month, and I've just kind of been putting off doing it. But anyway, back to Mark. So Mark Gieschek, my partner on the Over the Counter podcast. So some of you contrarians who listen to both know what that is. Mark did a talk at the Air Force Academy down in Colorado Springs, and he lost his voice. Now, he had had a sore voice for a couple of days, and then he did a talk, and then he couldn't talk the next day. So it was great. He was walking around with this little notebook, in writing all the answers in it. So I threatened to interview him on the show, like I interviewed the post-it note that Sarah the quitter Stacy left on my microphone arm that one time. I was threatening to interview Mark on my show while he had no voice and just like make up all of his answers that he was writing down on the pad, and no one would know the difference because he can't talk. I didn't do it though. I thought I'd get myself in trouble and tick off a friend if I did that. Other than that, real fast, I want to talk a little bit about this WikiLeaks thing, and I may run this into the second segment here in a second, but oh my goodness. My kind of patriotic, you don't mess with America side is like, I'm mad that they're like giving away the secrets of how we do things and how we spy on people. And part of me thinks that Julian Assange and WikiLeaks are like traitors. And the other side of me is like, yeah, we need to expose when our government is doing something sketchy, like spying on us through our hardware. It's like, I mean, bad government, don't do that. I mean, I'm living almost daily now. You know, I saw the news a second ago, Burger Chain is going to have a robot that flips burgers, all these different things. You know, I look over the news and I just have that crazy feeling that I'm living in a early 90s dystopian film. I'm watching the news that's in the film. it just freaks me out every time. But I think it's what's really, really, really dangerous is that it seems like they had hacked and gotten and captured some of the Russian ways and code and all that of hacking. And what's dangerous about that is not that, oh, they have better tools, is that we have tools that have their fingerprints all over them, and we can use those tools with gloves, and then we can make it look like they did it when we did it, and then there's just ramifications for that. So I'm going to explore the bigger issue around that a little bit when we get back, and then I got some other stuff up my sleeve. You're listening to The Counterposition. I'm your host, Andrew Whaley. We'll be right back.
Let my sacred word to mutter, ran too fast and turned to butter. I'm a bit too much for me to chew.
If you enjoy listening to Andrew Whaley on The Counterposition, you should become a friend of the show. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.
Let me skip across the pond. I'm an ocean on and on. I'm a fish with no bow that I outgrew. Lift my blood. See only one on track.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your hungry host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right. We were talking about WikiLeaks and about the attribution of hacks through the way that they track back code and the fingerprints that are on certain things. Now, as you know, if you listen to the show, especially all the way back into the primaries, I am not a fan of Donald Trump. He is the president now. So I'm trying to give the guy his props when he does well, call him on stuff when he doesn't do well, and just, you know, every time he doesn't act like a divisive cartoon character, I'm like, well done. You know, it's like when you have kids, you know, you have to praise them when they do good, you know, and that way, you know, they learn, you know. It's like it's training. But I was certainly not a fan in any way, shape, or form. But it is interesting that people, you know, the hacking of the DNC and all that, and all those emails that were released, and that they've pretty much, everyone says, I heard someone on NPR today arguing that bipartisan, no one disagrees now. It's pretty much given. Russia interfered with our election. They hacked stuff and released emails. They set out fake news propaganda stuff. They interfered. But with this WikiLeaks thing, I'm going, well, how do you know it was the Russians? How do you know that Donald Trump wasn't on the way to beat Clinton, the DN, and then, you know, the powers that be in the Democrat world, you know, the Obama administration saw that they should have went with Bernie Sanders, but the whole Debbie Wasserman Schultz and all that, and the whole DNC's attacking of Bernie Sanders behind the scenes and sabotaging his campaign and favoring Hillary Clinton was a mistake, and now they were going to lose, so they had to have a reason why they lost, and so they sabotaged their own campaign using Russian hacking software to make it look like Russia did, so then they could attack Trump after he won and discredit kind of a grassroots movement among white working class America that had been ignored by the Democrats. Now that's big time conspiracy theory, but that's the kind of crap that goes on. And I saw this article the other day that just listed, okay, look, here's who we know we were wiretapping. We're all this stuff about wiretapping Trump. It's like we wiretapped tons of ambassadors, tons of leaders of foreign nations, including our allies. We recorded phone calls on like Angela Merkel's cell phone. Anybody remember that? Remember when that came out during Obama? It's like we don't have a problem tapping people and grabbing their stuff. And now turns out you don't need to put an actual wiretap. This isn't Watergate. You don't send guys in dressed as, you know, house cleaners under clandestine cover of night, and they put bugs. They don't unscrew light bulbs and put bugs under the light bulbs, or when, you know, you can sweep for bugs. This is all digital stuff, right? And it turns out that we have the tools to do that, and we have Russia's tools that they use to do that. And I'm just like, so I mean, I don't want to take this in a partisan political direction, because I really am so absolutely disdainful of both sides right now. And you know, I just, you know, the how to say it, what is that quote from the Joker in Batman, where he's like, I'm just like a dog I'm chasing a car. If I caught it, I wouldn't know what to do with it. I think that's the entire RNC now. That's the entire Republican side of the House. They have the presidency. They have both houses of Congress. And we can't get a tax cut through. They have passed 40, they have repealed Obamacare 40 times or something, and they can't manage to. Did you not, all that time you were sitting there, did you not come up with an alternative? Were you not? And I think that that's, I didn't mean to go this political today, but you know what? Fine. We'll do a political segment. See, here's the thing is that people just, when you don't have power, you can just sit and just chuck rocks at something over and over again and just kind of just do these protest votes and all that. Remember when there was a really big, long speech by Ted Cruz on the floor, and it was just calling them all on the carpet about not doing their job and just doing these stupid protest votes and all this stuff. And I remember listening to it. David Quackenbush sent it to me, and I was like, okay, I kind of see the Ted thing now. I mean, I'm kind of not upset. I still think he's smarmy, but back then I kind of was feeling Ted a little bit after I watched that talk, and that's what he was talking about. So I got a crazy idea. This is an open question to everyone in power with an R behind your name. What have you been doing for the last 8 years? Just passing protest votes, repealing Obamacare that you know are going to get knocked down. Why didn't you do that once, go, okay, they won't let us, and then spend the rest of your time coming up with a real plan, an actual plan, so that when we did win the power back in Washington, we go, oh, hey, we got this plan, let's do this. No, they didn't do it. They sat there lobbing water balloons over the fence that is the DNC, and just raining on their parade all day, and you know, and but not actually contributing anything, not even actually plotting their takeover. They seem to have been caught off guard by the fact that they actually won. Annoys me. But anyway, getting back, I get fired up. I get fired up. I'm trying to get politics up for Lent. I get fired up when I start talking about politics. But God bless Rand Paul. Rand Paul, I love me some Ron Paul. I love me some Rand Paul. Rand Paul is like, no, 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 no. We are not going to do this. I mean, we're not going to just, in the name of speed, just half-ass together some kind of like couple of tweaks on this, give a bunch of it some new names, and then just like crank it back out. And it's like Republican welfare. Here you go. He's like, no, we're going to go back. We're going to start from scratch. And we're going to build something that's actually principled and real, that is sustainable, that's not going to cost more than this does, that we can just defend because it's us. And we're not going to keep doing something that we can't afford, so that we have to keep borrowing money. I mean, put it this way. Think about this. Since I started this show, our government has borrowed from China and all kinds of people, people that we're not friends with, in the form of bonds and all this stuff. The government has borrowed more money since I started this show than most of us will ever make in a lifetime. Most of our families, extended families, will ever make in a lifetime, has been borrowed from a foreign power that we're not friendly with since I started this show. Now, go fact check me on that and see if that's true. But I'm going to bet it is. I think it is. So we got to start getting real about this, you know? All right. So since I'm going down a political route, I'm going to do a political segment. Man, I've been listening to, I was listening to a news show, and they were talking about the immigration thing. And I'm like, this is one where I'm not as opinionated. I am really just at a stalemate, and I'm frustrated with both sides. On one side, I'm a Catholic, and I believe in Catholic social doctrine. I think it's humane. I think it's moral. I think it's real. And I think that people have the right, if you're sitting in Mexico and you can't feed your family, and there's a job across the border that someone needs to give you, and law is in the way, I think you have the right to come work that job. You know, I've ranted several times about the stupid idiot, you know, dairy industry and the prices set on milk and the lack of agriculture visas for dairies and all that. And it's a recipe for illegal immigration, right? So great. There's a dairy that would shut down without illegal aliens. And I'm sitting in Mexico broke and watching my family starve, and they got a giant help wanted sign hung on the side, on the other side of the border wall, so to speak. And the only thing standing in the way is technically these laws or whatever. I mean, I understand. I get it. Now you go some parts of Mexico, my God, you get into like Guatemala and Honduras. I mean, the threat of violence and gangs that people live under there, it's like, I can't imagine, but I think we should just be able to give these people political asylum. But people from Central America are coming here, like tens of thousands of people. And it's like, okay, well, at some point it's like, can we keep helping? It's like, and then what really ticks me off is then you listen to these people, and this is what got me going today, is this. There was this woman, that woman who went in for her appointment. She comes in every 6 months, checks in with ICE because she was busted for using a stolen Social Security number, and she was already in the country illegally. She was given a voluntary leave chance, like you can take off, go. And she didn't do it. And she did it, and she like went and got a job and like stole a Social Security number. She didn't go home. She's got a husband. She's got American kids because they were born here. And she didn't go home. She didn't go back to Mexico. And now she's here illegally. She goes into the ICE office and they deported her. Now, I'm torn because a woman who's been here 20 years, who has a bunch of kids and a husband, who's working a job, that's not who I'm really worried about them deporting. But at the same time, these people that are just crying that this is completely unjust, I'm like, dude, see what would happen to you as some white middle-class person if you stole someone's Social Security number and then went and worked under it and then got busted. Or if you went and tried to sneak into Germany without crossing a border or something. I mean, it's like those are real crimes. It's like, are borders just illegitimate? Are borders inherently racist? I don't know, man. We just have a quagmire on our hands. We need to get something done in stone that is a really fair law with really fair immigration reform, and then enforce the living heck out of it And I don't know what we do with these countries that are unlivable at this point. So, all right, let's go to the break. You're listening to The Counterposition. Man, I'm fired up today.
Then how we crave a hanging in his dark.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
People singing, please don't sting, but please don't go.
Señores y señoras, bienvenidos a El Cano Posición. Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot. I was still thinking about immigration. Welcome back to The Counter Position. I am your frustrated host, Andrew Whaley. And what do we want to talk about in this third segment here? See, I did this political segment, which I didn't mean. I had like two little passing things I wanted to talk about. But I'm freaked out by WikiLeaks. I'm freaked out by the fact that I want to... Let me circle back to that for a second. There is a... modern experience of, and this will be a good transition into some of the other stuff I want to talk about. Modern experience of reality has increasingly become either an experience of reality echoed through the digital, or reality experienced directly, but by a mind that has been formed by the digital. Now, I know I just turned and got really heady on you, but hold on, come with me. When we think about that, remember whenever it's like, oh, I was watching, 24, the new season of 24. And they showed this woman, she said, I wasn't there. They're trying to frame her because she's a Muslim and there was a terrorist thing. And she's like, I wasn't there. I was out jogging. I was not there. I left the house. I was jogging. I went by this and this and this. And they had kind of cleaned the cameras and stuff and then added an image of her walking into the office right at the time she would have needed to walk in the office to do this thing that they had a digital stamp of her accessing this file, right? Now, they ended up being able to catch it, but this guy running for president had to pull in favors from like NSA-level tech to be able to detect that this was false. I remember not very long ago when, even when it came to video footage, you could believe your eyes, right? You know, you see these two guys broke into this jewelry store. Here's a security camera footage. One of them, here's a camera of them leaving. They were driving an 87 Pontiac Grand Prix or whatever. It's like, and you're like, but, and you felt pretty good about like, I mean, if they caught those guys, you're like, well, yeah, those are the guys in the video. But now it's kind of like, you know what, when they can put, you know, actors that are long dead in the movies, and they're not perfect, but I mean, if that was a grainy security film and the NSA and the people who had the ability to like catch it were the ones doing it, or I mean, that's sketchy. Now let's take this to the level of like this hacking thing, right? If the digital world and attribution of hacks and all that happens from a digital footprint from the tools used and little snippets of code that are in the tools. And you can tell that this showed up in this other hack over here and we caught the guys that did that. We know who this is and blah, blah, blah. This has the fingerprints of Russia, or this is clearly a Chinese hack because they always use this thing. And you see this code over here. And now WikiLeaks comes out and it's like, you know what, we've got, I mean, that's like, I mean, think about, let's take this out of the digital world and bring it back into like analog world, meat world crime, right? So that's the equivalent of having a knife covered in a serial killer's fingerprints that you can then put on plastic gloves, go kill someone in the same manner, in a copycat manner, and then leave that knife in a dumpster around the corner. They find it and it's got his fingerprints all over it, and you walk. That's what seems like they're showing with this WikiLeaks thing, is that we had that, except digitally. And instead of serial killers or like individual people, it was like the representation of a country that at one point we didn't have a good relationship with. At one point we had, in the 80s, I had to learn how to get under my desk, because if there was a nuclear attack, like being under your desk is going to make any difference. But I guess it made us feel better that we could actually do something, you know? I mean, that people don't remember the Cold War if you're young. It's like, I was still growing up under the threat of it. I remember waking up and having watched the night. I remember like watching the day after, I think it was called, on TV, and just watching the look on everyone's faces the next day when we saw that movie that simulated what it would be like if there was a nuclear attack in America, you know? There's images from that movie, like a horse running and then being lit up from behind, and you could see its skeleton stopped in midair. Then it's like ash. And then like a woman standing there and she's pregnant, and you can see both of the skeleton and the child skeleton. And then they're just like disappear. You know, I mean, I still remember some of these images, right? So people don't really remember the Cold War. And it's like, we can now kind of like take an adversary of that level back in the day that we're still kind of like, they're kind of a thugocracy at this point. And we got a president that seems to be kind of cozy with them, but we could turn right around and blame them for something. You know, that's, I don't know. I don't like the idea that we've taught everybody that here's how you look at things, and that's digitally. And now we've shown that it's basically the equivalent of like, you know, like sleight of hand in with mirrors and stuff when you're using your real eyes in a room or something, or like those old time seances where they would, you know, have something hidden and make the table move or something. It's like, we're getting to a point where we can't believe our eyes. It's our digital eyes, but maybe we can't believe our eyes. It's that's sketchy. That's super sketchy. All right. I'm getting off of, I had no plan. I had these literally two small little hashes, like two little, like, hey, mention this in passing on my outline. All right. David Brooks and R.R. Reno, did a talk at the New York Encounter this year for Community Liberation. R.R. Reno is the, editor in chief of First Things magazine. And, David Brooks is a columnist, a conservative opinion writer, journalist for the New York Times, which he likens to being the chief rabbi of Mecca. and he's also, you know, on PBS NewsHour and all kinds of stuff, and really great thinker. I'm really interested in David Brooks. I like him. He's kind of had a spiritual resurgence lately. He was a secular Jew, I think, growing up, and he's gotten to be friends with Tim Keller and it wasn't New York Presbyterian, is at that church. Anyway, he's gotten to be friends with him and kind of had a bit of a spiritual revival, you know? And so they had an interesting talk, and the same topic that they had a talk about, or part of their talk was about, came up with a friend of mine. So I was talking to an old friend that I went to college with a million years ago. And we've kind of reconnected over Facebook, started talking on the phone. And she was saying that, we were just talking about, you know, how do you get to this place in life and, you know, either, you know, not be sure what you're doing or trying to figure it out, or not still be single when you wanted to be married, or, you know, how do you, you know, and she said something along the lines about the digital kind of world makes you think that you just have infinite choices with like your vocation and what you're going to do. And I was like, yeah, you know, these guys, and they talked about this, and it's interesting. I feel like that we've lost kind of the structure to the kind of the image that R.R. Reno uses. There used to be this railroad in your life, and there was these tracks. It wasn't just an open field that you could just drive where you wanted to. There was this track, and it was called, you grow up, you work hard, you go to college, you get a job, you get married, you have some kids, you know, you get further in your career, you move on, you kind of, you give back, you see grandkids, you know, and you retire, and then you pursue meaningful things. And there was this track, right? Now, you could stop on this track and you could take side route. You could take side trips. You could like take off and go to the Peace Corps for a year or two and then come back, because that society kind of like, and the expectations and the way things were done or whatever, this track was still still there for you to get back on the train, right? And how in Brooks was talking about how like his students are just like, no, this, you're in the middle of an ocean. You don't know where your destination is, but you know that there are infinite destinations. You don't have any real compass about how to get there, but you have infinite choice and freedom in which direction you'll go. But there's an immense amount of pressure to get somewhere really interesting and really meaningful, and in a really interesting, meaningful route. You know, I'm paraphrasing, but that's about what I took from it. And man, I can really feel that. It's like, as I look at my life and I'm making some decisions and saying goodbye to some ideas and some possible projects and starting to focus on some others and really just kind of trying to go, look, I mean, I'm 46 years old. If I'm going to leave behind anything in this world that looks like what God called me to do or something of any enduring worth, be that a family or a business or a model of ministry or a piece of art or a work or something, I'm going to have to get on it, you know, or start eating a whole lot healthier. One of the two, because I'm running out of time, you know, mortality kicks in right about 38, 39. You start really going, it seems like in my late 30s, really 40, 41, 42 is kind of when it really hit me, is that you stop thinking about the distance. I used to think about how long has it been since I graduated high school? What year, what reunion is this? How long has it been since? And right about 40, you start thinking, how long have I got? How much longer is there? You know? And I think that that's good. That's reality slapping you in the face and making you put down a bunch of things you picked up. So, all right, let's go to the break. When we get back, I'm going to try to wrap this up and see if I can't bring it someplace interesting. You're listening to The Counterposition.
Then all the color glass that painter's palette smash, all the colors of my soul.
If you enjoy listening to Andrew Whaley on The Counterposition, you should become a friend of the show. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.
I'm a hyena laughing fool. I'm a hero without anyone to save. Love decked myself in toys. I'm a poor and kingly boy. Oh, I'm lovely. Oh, I'm lovely. And I'm dull.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your tired and in need of coffee host. Oh, we are talking about freedom and vocation and life plan and how to get, whether infinite choice versus a direction that society gives us. You know, and about mortality. That's where we ended up on. And let me repeat what I was saying. So you have these, when you're young, nowadays, you think you have these infinite choices and you feel you bear the weight of these infinite choices and bear the weight of the need to get someplace interesting and meaningful in an interesting and meaningful manner and preferably blog it and tweet it along the way so that people can go back and see how cool it was. Maybe do a podcast, call it Startup or call it something else. There's always people doing these podcasts about all the mistakes they make and decisions they make along the way so they can document how they get there. So even the path of how you get from A to B has to be interesting and the where you get has to be meaningful. That's a lot of pressure. Anyway, so versus, you know, kind of a track, you know, used to, you know, a certain kind of expectation of everyone around you and kind of the way things work and, you know, some less options. And so the thing that David Brooks and our arena were talking about is that freedom is in choosing your limits. So you could say, you make a permanent choice to, oh, I'm going to be radically available for the good of others and to approach and be in relationship with God in a way that people that are distracted by the rest of stuff can't be. So I'm going to become a priest or a monk or a nun or a consecrated virgin or something. And I'm going to live my life in the service of others and in contemplation of the true, the good, and the beautiful. And then you put this line in the sand, you take these vows, and then this far you do not cross, dude. And you then now you've got a barrier, right? Or at one point before marriage was the mutual exchange of power of attorney with the reasonable expectation of helping each other get some sexual pleasure every once in a while until you're both kind of done. And then, you know, it's, you dissolve it and split the house and the kids up. I mean, before marriage was that, you took a vow and you're like, oh, now I can't sleep with other people. I'm gonna sleep with you. And I can't just take off and go do some stuff because we're going to make some kids. And then I'm going to have to show up on Monday morning and make some money so that these kids don't starve. And I'm going to, if I can't just pick up and be like, hey, I'm going to go check out Portland. I hear it's pretty cool. Like, I'm going to move there. I'm going to fill my car with some stuff that I have, you know, and just sell everything else. Just take off and, I don't know, maybe get a job in a coffee house and just dream of the 90s is alive. You know, you can't do that because you own a house and you have a wife and kids, and the kids are in school and they have friends. So like, moving is a big deal. So you don't just stop and just on a dime go do something. I've moved roughly every 5 years. Now that I think about it, you know, like almost every 5 years I've had a fairly major move. And because I'm not dragging anybody with me. But there's a thing, is that the frustration that I feel, I think that it's more freedom. I sit down and I write in my journal about what I want my life to be like. And I want to be able to sleep in without an alarm clock, because I don't think it's natural to have to get up, you know, awakened every day by some electronic rooster. And I don't want to have to go to bed really early every night so that I feel refreshed before the rooster wakes me up. I want to be able to just kind of stay up and just go with the flow and then wake up when I wake up. And I want to be able to turn the phone off for days. And I want to be able to travel and not worry about what happens back. I start getting this like Tim Ferriss 4-hour work week, you know, complete and total freedom, absolutely no responsibility. I just pick up, go someplace, sit around in flip-flops, write a book, turn it in whenever I'm done. They give me money for it and I repeat, you know, that's kind of what I want. Sorry. You know, every once in a while, if I happen to be in the country, I show up, do an interview, they pay me a bunch of money and I leave. It's like, that would be the ideal. I want to have absolute total freedom, but that's not really where happiness is. There are times when I get a day off and I'm like, all right, now given it's because my mind is going 300 miles an hour, 'cause I have so much going on, I'm worried about everything. And maybe if I had a bunch of money and knew that I didn't have to worry about that, maybe I would be able to shut off. But if you're a long, 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 long time listener to the show, you remember my episode talking about the lake up in the mountains by Lander, Wyoming, and how unsettled my heart was when I had my own mountain lake. I don't have to be, I have no cell signal. I have nowhere to be until the next day. It's in the middle of the day on a beautiful day, and I have a mountain lake, nothing but the gentle wind waves lapping against the shore, a eagle flying overhead, and the sun glinting off the water, total silence and beauty. I could not still my heart, right? Freedom is not the issue. There are days I have a day off and I get nothing done and I can't clear my mind enough to read or to think or to do anything. It's freedom's not the issue. I have friends of mine, Mark Yischek, God love him, without a voice. Now his voice is back now. Mark gets more done on a Wednesday with a full-time job, teaching at a college, a wife and kids and a house and a mortgage and all this. He gets more done than I do on a Wednesday. Because he's just figured out that you're not going to get these big unstructured swaths of time. And so when you get an hour or 45 minutes, you write a blog post and you go, hey, I need to write my blog today. I got 45 minutes to do it. What's been on my mind? What can I write in 45 minutes? And then you do it and it's good and you learn how to do that. But it's in picking your limits. This is the main thing that I've learned. Choosing to make commitments, choosing your limitations, choosing to make commitments that limit yourself. The freedom is in choosing which commitments. The freedom is not, I mean, this is the old dream of the 60s, right? You know, the it's like, oh no, man, we're just going to float around and it's going to be beautiful. And we're not going to have, don't need no dollars, man. It's all good, brother, man. We're just going to float around and we're just going to do whatever we want. Whenever we want to do, we're just going to do what we feel, man. We're just going to feel and do whatever we feel. And we're just going to have sex with everybody. And we're just going to play a bongo drum. And we're just going to paint some flowers on our faces. And we're just going to be, man, it's going to be great. It's like, no, it doesn't work that way. That is not where freedom is. Now, to their credit, a lot of those baby boomers that were out there at Haight-Ashbury saw that that ended in a very ugly place and they gave up on that dream, right? But because they weren't all stupid. Some of them are still trying to live that dream. But that complete being unmoored, being unmoored, but not being, you know, in dock, not being with the anchor down and not, you know, setting a definite course is not freedom. That's called being adrift. Now, there is something to be said. In these, the old hippies knew this. They used to have a saying that I've just been accidentally quoting when I'm talking about this new coffee house project. They used to say, be here now. Just be here now. You know, David Brooks, this is what got me thinking about this. David Brooks talking about how he grew up with nothing but just natural, common public culture because his parents were completely unreligious and they were like hippies. And they took him to a be-in where we're just going to all show up like a sit-in. That's going to be a be-in and they're just going to show up and they're just going to be. You know, it's like, but they used to say, be here now, right? You know, so there's something to be said that in that process, in whatever you're doing, whether you're acquiring company, doing the dishes, walking the dog, feeding the kids, cleaning up afterwards, you know, having an argument with your wife or making love to your wife, be in that moment. And heaven forbid, if you go get a cup of coffee, just have a cup of coffee. Leave your phone in your bag. Don't pull your laptop out. Have a conversation with some people around you that you don't know. That is another rabbit trail from another time. And that's a big fat part of my outline I didn't get to. But no, it seems like it's like jazz. Once you accept that there are some general boundaries and this is your instrument, this is the instrumentation, this is the time signature, this is the key we're in, then you can riff inside those boundaries. You can kind of push the boundaries and break the rules here and there once you've learned them. Once you've committed to the boundaries, then there's a bunch of freedom there inside this space. And freedom on the, if you're on the boat, go back to my boat metaphor. If you're on the boat, and you're going to this particular place and you have a course set in and you've checked the weather and you've got it locked in on this course and you're not going to go off one way or the other, then yeah, you've got the freedom to read a book or take a nap or get some work done or work out or cook some food or do something. You've got some freedom once you've chosen where the boat is kind of going and you've committed to this boat in this ocean, on this track, going to this place for this reason, then you can kind of like riff along the way. But this is totally not the show I expected to do. This was like point number two. I have two giant points on my show that I didn't get to. This is what happens when I have low blood sugar and not enough coffee in me and I go ahead and do the show. Oh, well, let's pull the plug, pop the cork on this little thing we like to call the counter position. Thanks for coming out, kids.
I take your place, marble stone. I take your place, marble stone.